in the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
All right. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us Friday mornings for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places and things. This week, in the middle of World War II, in fact, 77 years ago tomorrow, the Port of Seattle renumbered all the piers on the Seattle waterfront.
Morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
I think about, the old Pier 48 where Northwest Book Fest was held in the 90s, or Pier 54 where Ivers has been forever. I've taken those numbers for granted all my life, but they do only date back to May 1st, 1944. That was when a new system was adopted, with pier numbers from 24 to 91 going from south to north along the central waterfront. The numbers replaced what had been something of a hodgepodge of piers named for the businesses there. There was Whiz Fish Products Company, or Isaacson Ironworks, or Leslie Salt Company. Or for the adjacent street, like the Bell Street Terminal, which still has most of that name, even though it also became Pier 66 77 years ago. Now, the numbers below 24 were reserved for the Duwamish Waterway in West Seattle, and I think they did use most of them. I've looked at the charts pretty closely. They curl around Harbor Island in counterclockwise direction, then reverse direction moving west. It's all pretty confusing. I think they got down to Pier number 2. I couldn't find Pier number 1. I think number 2 was the lowest. Now, numbers above 91 were reserved for the Ship Canal, Lake Washington, and Lake Union. I don't think they ever used any of those, as far as I can tell. I did find a Port of Seattle map from 1918 that showed the names of all the old piers, and we'll have that at My Northwest. It's kind of a fun list of old Seattle companies and steamship lines from a time when the waterfront was all business. It wasn't like a place you walked around and ate popcorn. It was all about moving people and merchandise through the piers. There was also an earlier series of numbered piers in the middle of the central waterfront. It added to the confusion. The public entity, the port, was only created in 1911. It took decades for them to gain control of what had been a hodgepodge of privately owned piers and wharfs that railroad and steamship companies owned on Elliott Bay. And it's really no surprise the new numbering system came in during World War II. That was when tons of military supplies and thousands of soldiers and sailors were moving through Seattle. The waterfront was completely militarized during the war. The military, they controlled the harbor. They saw the need to make the pier system easier to navigate, and it's really easy to see why that made sense to do that. And in the old newspaper clippings, the pier numbers appear to have caught on by the late 1940s in terms of the media talking about where something happened or where something was going to happen. But I'd guess there were probably still some crusty old sea dogs who never stopped calling their favorite pier the Grand Trunk Pacific Wharf or the Dodwell Wharf or whatever. But it's 77 years ago tomorrow. Now, I had two little quick updates on the tail end of the story. One is at the old Renslow Trestle we talked about here a few months ago. It crosses I-90 east of Ellensburg, carries the Palouse Cascades Trail. It's officially open as of yesterday to hikers and bikers and equestrians. It's this amazing, if you've ever driven across the state, you know the trestle I'm talking about. Yeah, it's open now with a safety rail and everything, so it's open to the public.
All right, just in time.
Last quick update. We talked back in September about the city of Spokane trying to adopt a new flag. And if you have a city of Spokane library card, today's your last day to go online and vote for your favorite of the 12 finalists. We have a link at My Northwest. So if you're a Spokaneite, you can get online and choose what the city's going to adopt for its new flag.
Do you have a favorite?
I wish I did. They're all pretty good. I mean, I'm not a Spokaneite. It's hard for me to say, but they're all, I don't see a favorite among any of them, actually. I'm a little shocked.
Okay. Well, we'll have to wait and see, I guess. All right. Thanks so much, Felix.
Thanks, Anna.
Biden administration in day 101. I promise that we will stop counting days, probably sometime around this weekend. We called up CBS's John Dickerson, who's hosting Face the Nation this weekend, to remind us why we put so much emphasis on that milestone.
Oh, we could be here till breakfast. yes, it's people will say, well, it came from FDR. Sure, it did, but doesn't even have to do actually with FDR's presidency. The 100 days came from the length of the emergency session in 1933 when Congress was churning out bills, I think 76 of them, in response to the Great Depression. Many weeks later, FDR gives a fireside chat and refers back to that period, and that's where the 100 days began. But the funny thing about that speech is he says 100 days is too early to assess the presidency. You have to wait a little bit longer. So we're honoring FDR by counting at 100, even though FDR said that was too soon to assess the presidency.
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with that. About 100-ish days ago, you wrote that Joe Biden has a real shot at being a boring president. It will require constant work. How do you think he's doing?
Well, I think he's doing pretty well. That concept of boring was based on an interview I did some time ago with Leon Panetta, who was the chief of staff at the White House and, of course, Secretary of Defense and head of the CIA, and his argument was that a competent president is a boring president, that a lot of the presidency happens outside of the limelight, and that it should. And so that if a president is sticking to the job and what's actually required in the job, you won't be seeing the president hopping around on Twitter and bouncing across your cable television screen, because the president will be too busy manning the actual job. That's what the job requires. And then the Biden administration has taken the view that basically after President Trump, being a kind of calmer, less in the news cycle every moment president is maybe something the country wants.
A little less celebrity, maybe.
Right.
And for the young people and the parents of young people, and honestly, even I think still some adults who might be listening, where is the Biden administration on canceling student debt? Is it still at least part of the conversation? I mean, I know people my age who I'm not going to reveal, but who are still dealing with their own student debt.
Sure. And partially that's what's animating his push for free community college. That was a part of his speech. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday of this week, is not only to cancel or amend it for those who have it existing, but not to create the conditions where, you know, to get an education of any kind, you end up burdening yourself well into your earning years. I think it's something that they're looking into in the White House, but I'm not sure where things stand and where they are in terms of the amplitude of what he might be able to propose, and then, of course, what would ever be able to pass through as any kind of legislation.
Sure, right. And you have Senator Tim Scott on the show on Sunday. What did you think of his rebuttal to the president's address?
Well, politically, we heard Mitch McConnell asked about Donald Trump, and he said, you know, we're not looking at the past. The future of the party is Tim Scott. So in terms of what Republicans want to, how they want to position their party, when you see Tim Scott, that's what they would like, you know, people to think about the Republican Party. So that's sort of interesting. I think it was kind of your traditional response speech, which is itself sort of interesting in the sense of, you know, it said basically that Joe Biden wasn't wanting to work with them. And you know, Democrats have claimed that about Republican presidents, which is only to say what's interesting is how much salience does that argument have now? And one of the bets that the Biden administration is making, I think, is that people aren't necessarily going to penalize him for not passing bipartisan legislation. If the legislation that does pass, like the $1.9 trillion relief package, is legislation that they like. And so it'll be interesting to see how salient an attack on Joe Biden for not working with Republicans is. Also, because when we look at our polling, Biden actually, people think he is trying to reach out to the other side, in part because they just think he's nice Uncle Joe, and of course that's the kind of thing he would do. But one of the other things that interested me was that it was a relatively policy-oriented response. I mean, obviously it had lots of politics in it, but it was, if you listen to the wide variety of criticisms coming from the right, a lot of it has nothing to do with policy. It's all culture war stuff. And there was a different mix in his response than we've seen from some other quarters.
Imagine having at least $500 a month in guaranteed income. Not for working, not for selling anything. It's just yours. That's exactly what at least 100 people in Tacoma are about to get as Tacoma launches its guaranteed pilot program.
Why Tacoma? Why now? Why is it important to support our local families? Well, pre-pandemic, we know that 40% of Tacoma households struggled to make ends meet. The cost of healthcare, utilities, transportation, and other essential living expenses is over $72,000 in Tacoma and Pierce County. Yet half, 50% of our residents don't earn that amount. National statistics tell us that most families don't have the ability to even afford a $400 emergency, whether that's a flat tire, or something that breaks in a house, or the ability for children to participate in certain activities, that money does not exist for most families.
That's Tacoma Mayor Victoria Woodard talking about the new pilot program they're about to launch this summer that will give that $500 to at least 100 Tacoma people who live in Tacoma.
Why Tacoma? Why now? I believe as a city, as we call ourselves a compassionate city and the city of destiny, it is our responsibility to make sure that everyone who lives in our community has what they need to be successful. We talk a lot about equity and the importance of supporting those who need it the most. And in my opinion, this is one way to not just talk the talk, but walk the walk.
Now, this pilot is a partnership with United Way of Pierce County. Donna Ponpinto is the president and CEO.
So what are we going to do? $500 a month for no less than 12 months. And this is meant to be a supplement to their income and other benefits. We want to target at least 100 participants chosen at random from a pool of qualified individuals. And we'll also have a control group as well, because a lot of this is about research and being able to garner the kind of information that we need to really build a case for guaranteed income projects across the country.
And she says,
participants must be qualified Tacoma residents. And we're going to focus on single-headed households, because we know that during the COVID, single heads of households were greatly impacted.
Now, it's not a brand new idea. This is something that was already tried in Stockton, California.
And then what we saw in Stockton, I'm sure going to see the same thing in Tacoma, is that folks know how to, the issue isn't that everyone who doesn't have money doesn't know how to manage money. The issue is that folks don't have enough money to manage. We know that folks aren't just sitting around waiting for Mayor Witters or Michael Tubbs or the government to save them. Folks aren't just don't want to be dependent on government for everything.
And that's former mayor of Stockton, California, Michael Tubbs.
But what folks need is the government to provide a springboard to opportunity, to make sure that the safety net doesn't have holes, to provide that income floor. And I'm so excited to have Tacoma be part of this movement. Congratulations to the mayor, to United Way. I'm proud that Mayors for Guaranteed Income, we also put in $500,000 to this effort, because that's how strong I believe, not just in the leadership of your mayor, but the potential, the intelligence, the resilience of your constituents.
And the mayor of Tacoma has also come up with a name for this new effort, the new pilot program. It is called Growing Resiliency in Tacoma, which has quite a bit of meaning about it, and it's all about lifting people up. Again, this is 100, at least 100 people in Tacoma who will qualify for this at random, and they will be able to track how those people spend the money, and this is all through private donations. No tax dollars were used on this at all. You can find out more at uwpc.org/growing-resilience-tacoma. And it's not the only place where we see some of these discussions going on. In the very large budget just passed by our state legislature, there's $77,000 set aside to look into the feasibility of launching a pilot statewide for a universal basic income. So we'll see how that goes.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It's sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A celebrated artist from Easter Island comes home to share her passion through the island's first music school. CBS's Khalifa Sunny has the story. And I will play that story for you right now.
Concert pianist Mahani Teave has traveled the world, but Rapa Nui, sometimes known as Easter Island, is her home.
Rapa Nui, that's what we call ourselves here also. That's our people, the Rapa Nui people.
It's a triangle-shaped island about the size of Washington, D.C., but way out in the South Pacific. And it's best known for these statues, called Moai. Scholars think they were built to honor the island's elders.
Our ancestors were all voyagers, and maybe that's what's in my blood, too, this coming and going.
In the 1700s, Dutch explorers came to Rapa Nui. They landed on Easter, so they called it Easter Island.
Easter Island, that's the English name.
Miki Makihara, a linguistic anthropologist at Queens College in New York, has been studying Rapa Nui culture for 30 years.
We're talking about a place that's only been inhabited by humans for maybe 1,000 years.
That is true, right? But a lot has happened.
In the late 19th century, slave raiders from Peru abducted about half the island's population. and left behind smallpox, which killed many of the remaining islanders. Only 111 Rapa Nui survived. Nowadays, Rapa Nui is part of Chile, which is the closest mainland, 2,000 miles away.
It's a remarkable history of survival and reconstruction.
Those 111 people kept the language alive and transmitted it to the next generation.
Yeah.
It's a comeback story.
Yes. Yeah.
We descend from those 111.
Mahane Teave was born in Hawaii to an American mother. But her father is from Rapa Nui, and she spent most of her childhood there.
I feel like so strongly about the island, and here are my roots. This is where I learned all my first everything.
She still remembers the day she heard that someone had brought something new onto the island, a piano.
We gotta go see that piano. Let's go see. So we get to the lady's house, and she opens the door. Please, can I go touch your piano? And I don't think she even got a chance to answer. And then after that, I was like, please, please, I want piano lessons.
There were no piano teachers on the island, so Teave asked the woman who owned the piano to give her lessons.
She got a piece of paper out, she drew some lines, and said, these are the notes, go home and learn them. I memorized what each little thing on each little line and space meant. And after a few days, she said, you know what, you can start coming to practice at my house.
In 1992, Teave's family moved to Chile, where she could study at a conservatory. She was 9.
Was that a scary time for you?
It was just a very confusing time. And at the same time, there's this possibility to be able to continue with, you know, wonderful music.
When she was 19, she left Chile to continue her studies, first in Cleveland, then Berlin. Soon, she was a celebrated concert pianist.
I would feel soaked with so many wonderful things, you know, going to amazing concerts and interacting with incredible musicians.
Did you always know you wanted to come back to Rapa Nui at some point?
Well, I always felt the connection to the island. What about the children? They don't have any chance to study, and who's ever going to do anything about it?
Teave returned to Rapa Nui a decade ago, and in 2014, she built the island's first music school.
A totally self-sustainable structure built.
Last year, it was featured in the documentary, Song of Rapa Nui.
We wanted to make an inspiring place, like a message of hope.
The school was constructed using an abundant, unnatural resource, trash.
We are in a garbage vortex. So, garbage from all over the world comes through the currents of the Pacific.
This school, built from garbage, is all about transformation.
Are you hoping to find the next great concert pianist on Rapa Nui?
The children have the possibility to develop their talents, but I really think it's important that they cultivate the values, the virtues that are learned. When you learn an instrument, you learn perseverance, you learn about teamwork, respect.
Before the pandemic, some people on Rapa Nui were concerned that tourism was damaging the island. Now, Mahane Teave says she's optimistic about the day when visitors can come back.
It's something that needs to find the harmony, because the way it was happening was not harmonious. Either to the island, to the people, to the nature. Give them an actual experience of what it really is to be here.
And maybe a concert.
Maybe a concert. But we need a concert piano, so.
This is a request from Rapa Nui, is less garbage, more grand pianos.
Exactly, more grand pianos.
From the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. It's G, Scott.
Hannah.
Hey.
This is the first time I've seen you in over a year.
I know. It's been forever.
Well, let me just say a few things. I know you probably have something to talk to me about, but let me talk to you about something. You look fantastic.
Thank you.
I love the hair.
Thank you.
What made you decide the hair stuff? What's
I
wrong?
Was working at home for a long time. And
let's
I said,
describe
you know
it for our listeners who can't see Hannah.
Go ahead, Hannah. You describe it. It looks good.
I cut about 6 or 7 inches off of it. And instead of the black with a little bit of silver kind of going on, I'm all red.
Fiery, yeah. Now, did you have the red hair with the red glasses today? And is that on purpose?
It is on purpose. I'm very color coordinated. It's my skill that I learned during the pandemic.
Does she fit the bill for Fresh Fridays, G?
Man, I'm telling you what, Colleen. She looks fresher than Fresh Fridays.
Let me see, G. Is he in the studio now?
He is in the studio
now.
Oh,
my. Let me see the Fresh Friday look, G.
Oh, well, you know, first of all, it's Seahawks, baby. Yes, Seahawks on mine. It's Blue Friday as well. Hey, are we talking about Seahawks today?
We are, yes,
because the draft.
Well, first of all, the Seahawks were phenomenal last night. I mean, I slept like a baby after what they didn't do yesterday. You know what they did? You know what the Seahawks didn't do yesterday? They didn't just pick some first-round pick that all of us goes to bed at night like, oh, boy, I hope this works out, right? No, they did not have a first-round pick. Why? Because they traded that pick last year to get Jamal Adams. And I thought it was a phenomenal move. It was fantastic then. It's even more fantastic now because we know what the Seahawks have, a really good safety. Now, what does that mean going forward? That means the Seahawks today, the second and third rounds will start today around 4 o'clock p.m., and the Seahawks will have a second-round pick. They will have the number 56 overall pick. And then, of course, you guys know they only have two picks after that. They'll pick in the fourth round at 129 and in the seventh round at 250. Now, in this case, what can we expect from the Seahawks? Well, there's two areas that I believe that the Seahawks need to really address. Number one, they really need to address the offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. Because the best player on their offensive line is their left tackle, Duane Brown. He is their best player. However,
mm-hmm.
I'm not saying he's old, but he's older, Colleen. All right? I don't want to get into ageism
What's
conversation.
Older in NFL terms?
Yeah.
31?
Yeah, that's older. You know what I mean?
Not 21 anymore.
Not 21, yeah.
Funny.
So in this case, they need to address the offensive line. So there's one. And then another area that they need to address is on the defensive side of things. And we can call this 1A and 1B. And 1A would be the cornerback position. That's a position that Richard Sherman used to play. They really need to address that. They need more depth. And I believe that the way that they've drafted here recently, I think the cupboards are a little bare there in the cornerback position. And then the other positions is they need to add more to the linebacker core. And the reason why I'm saying that is this. Some of you are probably saying, well, what about KJ Wright? As much as I love KJ Wright, and if KJ was here, I would say this right in front of KJ, and he knows this. The game is starting to change. And what I mean by that is offenses are now getting faster. You guys are seeing more passes. And what's happening is defenses are going to have to start catching up. So remember back when we used to watch some of those football games where the score was 6-3? Well, that's no more. There's going to be more points scored now because that's where the NFL wants games to be more entertaining. Well, they're more entertaining. That means more points are scored. That means defenses are harder to stop. So the Seahawks have to go out and get faster linebackers, and I believe those are going to be the key areas that they address in the draft.
What I want to know,
yeah,
because I was so upset with last year's football season, you know, I didn't watch any of my team because they broke my quarterback early.
Do the listeners know you're a Cowboys fan?
They used to know that I was a Cowboys fan. Okay. But I'm not any fan now. I gave up.
Did you give up?
I got very upset last year. I didn't even like it that they played the season when as season started and the pandemic was kind of in full swing, I thought, you know what? You've got some guys playing, some guys not. Yeah. Somebody's going to get hurt.
True.
And then somebody did get hurt, and it was my guy.
It was your guy.
It was my guy. So I don't know what's going on with my team. So
yeah,
should I watch this year or not?
Well, I thought that the Dallas Cowboys drafted very well. I think that they took one of the best players in college football. Is the linebacker out of Penn State. His name is Micah Parsons. So I don't want to get too deep into the woods on different football, but I will say
your side.
The good news is the Seahawks get the draft today. It happens today at 4 o'clock. And I believe, Colleen, that the two positions that I believe that they address will be offensive line and or the linebacker positions.
And then after that, on Monday, let's talk about addressing the Russell stuff.
That's
because
it.
I want to know if they've made him happy yet.
No, you know what? Stop it with that drama. There is absolutely nothing wrong with Russell. What you need to do is talk about Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers.
Let's do it. Let's do it Monday.
See you guys.
I want to know about that. Okay. Good morning, 8:14. I'm Hannah Scott in for Dave Ross. This morning, we're going to talk about gun violence once again, especially in the Central District. There were several shootings again last night, including one more in the Central District. Joining me to have this discussion is my friend from Converge Media, Omari Salisbury. Good morning, Omari.
Good morning, Hannah. Thanks for having me on this morning for this important discussion.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. I know you and I have talked about the gun violence situation in the Central District, the promises that have been made, the lack of progress on getting a handle on it. And I know that the last year, the situation has even worsened. Well, describe it for us. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, we say that this is the silent epidemic, is this epidemic of gun violence that's impacting our community in Seattle and across South King County. Converge Media people that follow us there know that it's almost a daily mention where we want to keep what's going on top of head. But yeah, you know, the gun violence keeps increasing, unfortunately. And like you saw, a drive-by shooting there last night in the Central District. And, you know, it's no longer just a Seattle thing. It's definitely a regional meaning across King County. And, you know, there's groups out there, public health, Seattle, King County, one of them with their zero youth detention. They're trying to get a hold on things regionally. But right now, I mean, it's rough out there.
It is. And I know you recently had a chance to talk with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin about the gun violence. She's long lobbied for getting a handle on it, but not much has been done. And she seemed to say to you that perhaps the lack of progress on that is because this is happening in Black neighborhoods. I want to play what she said.
Every one of those lives is a brother, an uncle, you know, their family, and it impacts the whole community. I mean, I was surprised. On other programs, I spoke about the trauma of, you know, at 23rd and Jackson, having that shooting that even a two-year-old was hit, and why that doesn't catalyze a broader discussion. So I think we need to have that discussion.
That discussion. And then this is an interesting thing she said to you.
I know this. My heart believes that if we had that same level of gun violence and trauma happening in the North End and the University District with young men the same age, there would be a whole city catalyzed against it. And we have to have that same sense of duty and obligation and both the sense of grief for the families and the outrage that we as a city let it happen. And I think that that's a conversation we have to start having as a city.
Do you think that she's right about that?
Yeah, I think they're right there. Mayor Durkin's 100% on. You know, it's a lot of people that feel disconnected in the city, and you know, they feel disconnected. It's Black people, mostly poor people, people of color who are impacted here with gun violence. And you know, the thing is, that broader discussion I had with Mayor Durkin when I interviewed her was also the total silence. See, the thing is, the broad discussion ain't happening as well because the rest of the elected officials stay quiet about stuff like this. People act because, like, just because they might live in District 5 or District 6 and not in District 2 or 3, that they can't recognize the impact of the trauma and the impact on humanity that's happening here in the city. I would really challenge the city council. I would challenge them to stop being quiet. I would challenge them to use their platform, and let's really, as a city, see how we can address this, because it's impacting us. It's not only impacting the people, of course, that are murdered and their families, but it's traumatizing whole neighborhoods. And it's not okay for elected officials to sit there and run all this, their propaganda on their Twitter and everything else in their canned press releases. And when we're facing a real deal epidemic in our communities, they're silent. The only other person that has continuously spoken out on this that I've seen, if I'm wrong, people hit me up, is King County Councilmember Germaine Zahalai. Outside of that,
people are silent.
They are silent, and especially about the two-year-old girl that you heard the mayor mention in that last cut. It was quiet.
Let me say this. I mean, and believe it or not, of all people, Mayor Durkin was the only one who was really super vocal as far as city electeds around that tragedy up in NAM at the Northwest African American Museum. It doesn't cost anything. Hello, elected officials. Hello, elected leaders. It doesn't cost you anything to recognize that people are being impacted, that they're being traumatized. It doesn't cost you anything, even to offer a prayer. I'm going to tell you, these people downtown are out of touch.
And I don't disagree with you, and I know a lot of others do not as well. I want to talk to you about, I got a chance, and I don't know if you've been able to do this, I talked to King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg just this week, actually, about the latest numbers in the gun violence that we've been seeing, and I think 36% increase in shootings in 2020, and we're on track for that to be the same again this year. 16 murder cases already filed in 2021, 13 of those shootings, several of them involved in the Central District. I asked him, what are you doing about this? And here's what he said.
So King County has just set aside $2 million to begin and to seed a program where community nonprofits who want to do this work, and let's be clear, not everybody wants to work with young people who carry guns. It's very hard work. But there are what we call credible messengers, people who grew up in that neighborhood, who have maybe they went to prison for gun violence, or they were part of a gang structure when they were growing up. They have credibility with young people that a judge and a prosecutor never will. And so to pay those people a living wage to spend their time and their career interrupting gun violence. So when you find out that one group of people has been shot at by another group, they go and surround the victim group and say and try to talk them out of retaliation and give them other opportunities. You can take them out of town for a weekend or do something to cool down the situation. That is very effective public safety strategy, but we have to pay for it.
Agree or disagree?
I agree 100%. You know that Zero Youth Detention, Public Health, Seattle, King County, they've got big data on their side, right? And what big data is saying, that altogether, all of these shootings, directly and indirectly, I think it's in between 80 and 150 people for a whole county, everything that's happening in our county. And what they've been able to do is use their data. And from their data, you know, I mean, they respond to the hospitals. They respond to the neighborhoods. They try to disrupt gun violence. I mean, they're out there doing that work. You talk about people like Derek Wheeler Smith and Willard Jemison, Buki Gates, Sean Good. I mean, these guys are out there on the front line of it. Then definitely more investment. I think we could probably get more results. Something has to happen.
Is there a role for law enforcement here? I don't know if you got a chance. There was Chief Diaz said the other day that with the ongoing discussions at City Council about the cuts or taking more money from SPD as they lose their staffing and, you know, over 200 officers, I believe, since last year now gone. And he said the staffing issues are having an impact on their ability to deal with these investigations in the case of the 2-year-old and the 16-year-old.
So are you saying that Chief Diaz is saying that they're not investigating these crimes?
Not that he's not investigating, just that the resources are thin is essentially what the word was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that especially if you talk to people in these impacted neighborhoods, you know, it's all hands on deck. I'm not a policing expert when it comes to investigating homicides, but I mean, something needs to be investigated. You have your credible messengers, which Prosecutor Satterberg referred to, and there's also a side on this from law enforcement as well. You know, there's so many unsolved murders that are in our city. You know, I mean, it's just happening. There's literally murderers amongst us that are walking around. So, of course, law enforcement plays a role. And I think, I mean, I keep going back to Zero Youth Detention, but that's really a big part of their message there, is that the credible messengers play one part, the community. The community also plays a part. Like, we have to hold our community members accountable. You know what I'm saying? Where are your kids at? You know?
Right.
I mean, like, man, we need to look out for each other.
Absolutely. And I want to give you the last word on this. What are you calling on city officials to do?
All right. If I could get two words, I'm calling on city officials to just recognize, one, this is the easiest thing you can do. It won't cost you no money or anything, but recognize that people, families, and neighborhoods are being impacted almost daily in this city.
Why don't you recognize it? Use your platform to put some humanity out there. I mean, imagine someone was a drive-by right across the street from these Zells. That also impacts the business. Maybe people are scared to go there now. You see what I'm saying? The city council is in a unique position to use their voice. They got to stop being so selfish. I would say this, that like in Seattle, people's humanity, unfortunately, is directly tied to their political ideology. You know, and yep. Man, people need to step away from their politics and embrace humanity. The other thing I will say is this real quick, Hannah, is that at Converge, you know, we're the little engine they could, the lightweights fighting above our weight class. But, you know, Eric Calligraphy at Converge launched this Beloved campaign. And the Beloved, we're going to do what we can do. What we do is media. And we're going to use the meager resources we have and our media to get messaging out there to do our part for gun violence disruption. You know what I'm saying? We're not sitting on the sideline. We're not waiting for a handout or anything like that or a grant. Man, we're going to hit these streets and we're going to message the best way we can with our platform.
And I know you will, Amari, and it's always great work. Thanks so much for joining me. Always a pleasure. Amari Salisbury from Converge Media. 8:35. This weekend marks 10 years since U.S. Navy SEALs took out Osama bin Laden. We called up CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland to remind us how it all went down.
We had identified that Osama bin Laden had been living in this compound through CIA intelligence and actually some information provided by a Pakistani doctor who's still unfortunately in prison in Pakistan for his role in all this. Then the raid was mounted from Afghanistan. Helicopters moved into Abbottabad, landed. Unfortunately, one of them crashed in the process, but was able to crash safely enough for the team to get off, and the raid was executed. Osama bin Laden's body was then evacuated to be identified that was, in fact, him. And, of course, the team also picked up a large number of documents, computers, flash drives, cell phones, and all like that, sort of an intelligence bonanza in the aftermath. Bin Laden's body was buried at sea, to the best of our understanding, so there would not be a site for terrorists to, you know, to use as a pilgrimage in the aftermath.
Now, who has filled that void?
The void was filled by his sort of number two, a guy named Ayman Zawahiri, who actually was an Egyptian doctor. And he has presented sort of a shadowy virtual leadership for al-Qaeda, very infrequently seen. Recently, CNN did an interview with a couple of al-Qaeda operatives to provide their thoughts on the impending U.S. withdrawal. We don't see much of Zawahiri at all. Occasionally, there'll be podcasts released ostensibly by him. There have been reports that he has been killed. But clearly, in the last 10 years, as well as prior to that, al-Qaeda has suffered enormous setbacks in terms of degrading their organization. And significant numbers of their other senior leaders were killed, a number of them having matriculated to Syria as part of the ongoing Syrian civil war. But there's no doubt about it, even though we have executed significant damage to al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda's leadership, it's far from eliminated. And the question now becomes, as we pull out of Afghanistan, might they be able to use Afghanistan as a staging area for attacks in future? And, of course, the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda is also an open question. The Taliban had agreed to cut all their ties as part of the agreement signed by President Trump back there in February of last year. There are numerous reports since that they still maintain a relationship with the Taliban and a presence in at least two-thirds of the provinces in Afghanistan.
And the Taliban is still a threat?
Still a threat, no doubt about it. As President Biden, you know, said the other night, Hannah, in his remarks to Congress and to the nation. But al-Qaeda, since 2011, had metastasized. We now see an al-Qaeda presence in Yemen, an al-Qaeda presence in North Africa, certainly an al-Qaeda presence in Syria, and an alliance between al-Qaeda and people like al-Shabaab in Somalia. Some of these relationships, Shabaab is a good example, are kind of like franchise operations. There's a loose affiliation, but hardly one where al-Qaeda central is, if you will, manipulating those organizations on a day-to-day basis as far as the operations they conduct.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think over the years, the argument against pulling out has been the concern of destabilization in that region, correct?
No doubt about it. Destabilization in that region, and again, the possibility that al-Qaeda could once again, as they did prior to 2001, use Afghanistan as a place to train, organize, and equip terrorist organizations to conduct attacks on the United States or our allies. Now, again, Mr. Biden said in his remarks the other evening that the United States will maintain an over-horizon capability to ensure that doesn't happen. That all sounds good, but without a physical presence in Afghanistan, that'll be a tougher proposition in terms of where do you mount aircraft from, if you're going to use aircraft or special operations units to conduct a raid like we did in Abbottabad. And furthermore, how do you maintain intelligence on what's going on in Afghanistan? Can you depend on the Afghan government, if it survives, to provide intelligence? Can we depend on Pakistan to provide intelligence? That also becomes more difficult once all those troops are out and the bases are closed.
So, Colonel, I'll tell you, I'm the wife of a combat veteran who served in Afghanistan in 2013 before I asked this question, which is kind of a big ask, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on how collectively, after 20 years, our troops feel about pulling out at this point.
Well, you know, first of all, from one old soldier to another, thank your husband for his service. I think amongst the veteran community, it is mixed. 2,500 of our comrades, and I say our comrades, were killed in Afghanistan. About 20,000 or more were wounded. About 1,000 of our allies were killed in Afghanistan. And so the question for any veteran who served is always, you know, was this all worth it? I think all of them should hold their head high, because the one thing that has not happened in the last 20 years is we have not seen Al-Qaeda manage a large-scale attack like we saw on September 11, 2001, against the United States or even our allies. Have there been operations by them, particularly in Europe? Yes, there have. Has there been loss of life? Sadly, there has. We have not seen that massive attack, and that is because of our operations in Afghanistan. So that's certainly part and parcel of it. Certainly, with this anniversary, as Mr. Biden pointed out the other evening, I believe it was George W. Bush that said in the aftermath, we'll follow Osama bin Laden to the gates of hell. And the gates of hell took us to Abbottabad, Pakistan, in making sure that he was eliminated, which was a serious damage to Al-Qaeda. Again, whether that's enduring in future, whether Al-Qaeda now bounces back and becomes that global threat, obviously remains to be seen in measuring whether or not this overall effort of some 20 years and trillions of dollars was worth it.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.